on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11:29. Coming up next, Black Book Talk talks to Portland-born author Mitchell S. Jackson about his book Survival Math. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Siren Nation, presenting Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday, Saturday, May 4th at the Alberta Rose Theater, featuring performances from Arietta Ward, Pacific Trio, The Cabin Project, Sarah Clark, and more. Minors are welcome with a parent or guardian. Tickets and more information is available online at albertarosetheater.com.
You all appreciate it. When I was young, me and my mama had beef. 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, I'm scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell.
Good morning. This is Obi Hill with Mirror Image Books at KBOO Black Book Talk.
This is Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
Well, today we have the pleasure of talking with Mitchell S. Jackson, a resident of Portland, actually born in Portland in, 1975. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. I'm happy to be on KBOO, the house that J.W. Friday built.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, you are a wonderful writer, but you sound like, in reading the book, I kept thinking, he must have wanted to be a history major, too, because you just seem to have really, folks, if you want to learn the historical context for about anything, read this book, because he goes way deep in terms of, you know, what happened during Socrates' time, that had a play out during the Middle Ages, and then it came up to the 1920s. It is wonderful to have that thread, and of course, all the stuff that you know about North Northeast Portland is in itself a wonderful history. But yes,
yeah.
It's great.
Thank you.
We just connected in that you know O.B. Hill's family. Well,
yes.
While I was reading, I realized that your great-grandparents lived, I'm between Mason and Skidmore. And
oh,
I
wow.
live in the 4100 block, so they were right up, because they were at 6th and Mason, right?
Yeah.
So right in the same block.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there used to be a, right on the corner, there used to be a corner store there. I forget the guy who owned it, but I used to sneak in the store. I didn't want to sneak in.
You're talking about Mr. Cole.
Yeah, Mr. Cole, yeah. And he used to have all the candy. I would go in there and get me some Mike and Ike's and some Lemonhead, and he would always let me get a little extra. You know, I was a little short, but he would let me, you know, get a few extra pieces of candy.
Yeah, no place like home.
Now, what is this about Mr. Burger? What do you know about Mr. Burger?
That was the neighborhood, so you... Anything in like a 10-block radius, I walked around there. My mom sent me there, or an uncle or something. And Burger Barn, Mr. Burger, Fat Burger. I guess I was a burger connoisseur. But I really remember the Burger Barn, because that's where the adults congregated. And sometimes I would go over there a little past sundown, or even sometimes at night. And that was both like scary and exhilarating for me to see, you know, what the grown folks are doing when those kids are supposed to be asleep.
Okay, folks, you can see this interview is going to be old home week, but it really is all tied into a book. Now, probably the first time that many of us heard about Mitchell as writer was residue years, but now he is back with, as we said, Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. And I love this book. I just love photographs. And on the cover of this book, there are like 12 black and white, kind of sort of sepia tones, but they are photographs of black men. And we'll ask you a little bit more about this. But you did Residue Years, which was so, I felt it was like a fictionalized version of your life story. Why did you decide to come back and do this memoir? Why was there the need for Survival Math?
So I was both satisfied and disappointed in the reception to the Residue Years, and the disappointing part was it seemed like people were dismissing the kind of intellectual work that went into making a novel. And it really, I guess, Survival Math was born out of me wanting to kind of challenge the idea of how much thinking it goes into making a book. And I said, well, you know, one form that I think really makes the reader confront the writer's mind is the essay. And so I actually imagine Survival Math as an essay collection rather than a memoir, though I can see why people make that judgment upon it. But I was like, okay, essays to me are grounded in ideas, and I was really interested not just in the experiences of growing up in Portland and the history of Portland, but also like, well, what's the history and the cultural kind of context that allowed them to come to fruition.
You know, actually, you're absolutely right, because you could take any of these essays and just read them independently, and it would still be a full experience. And certainly nobody is going to question the intellectual rigor that was needed to produce this book. But okay, thanks for that explanation.
Yeah.
An interesting part of the book for me was that you used is not a good word, but that you have relatives and people that you love, and you're talking about their lives. And I liked that you talked to them about that you were going to do this, and it's explained.
Well, I think they could not, even though I interviewed, well, for the cover, I interviewed 16 men in my family, and I asked each of them the same question. What's the toughest thing you survive? And then I write their stories that they told me in second person narratives. But I also interviewed several other family members just to, for historical context, or, you know, to make fact check a memory that I had. But I don't think that any one person that I interviewed had an idea of the scope of what I was doing, and like how it would all, I don't even know if I had an idea of what it would look like in the end. So even though I asked them to tell me stories and I explained a little bit that I was working on a book, like I don't think they could really see it, see like what was going to be the result of whatever they told me. And I hoped, or I know that for them to give me the kind of personal stories that they did also meant that they trusted me enough to be, you know, honest and open with me.
So for Essie, Essie is your aunt. Cousin or aunt. For Essie's story, you talked to her son. I think his name is Jesse. So that's how you...
I don't reveal his name in the book, but I do... I talked to my mom more so about my aunt's story because her son was only a few years old when she passed. So
right.
He doesn't really have very much recollection. So actually my mom was the chief resource for most of the family history. I mean, I did a little bit of talking with my grandfather and some of my uncles, but I would eventually return to my mother to kind of fact check or clarify.
Excellent.
Now, you use a lot of street lingo in this book. It's something that people can really relate to if they may be around Batman's or Shadows or Mr. Slaughter's Top Q. Mm-hmm. Could you go into that a little bit, elaborate how you came about using that street lingo?
I think of it as the language of home. I think one place where you see people pushing the language and kind of resisting resisting the notion that the dominant language or conventional language is the only way to speak, or you know, kind of forging their own identity through the language, is in people who are involved in let's call them underground economies. And so my dad, a lot of my uncles, you know, a lot of the guys that I grew up with were involved in those kind of businesses or lifestyles. And so when I think about home and the people who had the most kind of unique ways of speaking, it's them. And I'm really trying to recreate that. But also, you know, I've lived in academia for a very long time now. I mean, almost, well, 15, 16 years. And so I do recognize that's also a part of my identity. So I'm lying if I go in either direction too far. I think there's like a balance that I'm trying to strike between, you know, this kind of language of home and the people who were really made impressions upon me, and then the world that I live in now, which is mostly academia and the literary world.
Isabel Wilkerson is a writer who has a book called The Warmth of Other Suns, and it's about, wow, like 600 pages long, and I'm not like the world's most dedicated nonfiction reader. She is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and you can tell because her book reads so beautifully that it's like a novel, and it was like the easiest 600 pages. And I thought about her as I was reading your book, because the blend of styles and languages, it's just very poetic. I don't know if you write poetry on the side, you know, just pure poetry, but your prose in this book is very poetic. Just a comment. But
yeah,
also,
yeah.
Do you write poetry?
I do. Well, I mean, not much poetry. I would never, I mean, I would love to be a poet. I don't think, I'm definitely not a trained poet. But I read as much or more poetry than I do prose. So I'm very interested in the poetics, in meter, in rhythm,
yes,
in cadence,
absolutely,
in diction, syntax. Like, all of those things are on my mind when I'm composing a sentence. And I do really like the breath of The Warmth of Other Suns. I actually had an event with Isabel like years ago, and was talking to her about the kind of the amount of work that she put in to that book, and I was saying like, "Well, what are you working on next?" And she was like, "Bitch, you're like, I put so much into that, I can't even think about what to work on next."
Right. But I just say that because if there are people listening who are saying, "Well, I don't read nonfiction," no, put that aside. Yeah. This book will really move you along. But really, actually, I also had a question, a follow up to what Emma said.
Uh-huh.
You did this whole chapter on, like, you know, admitting your mea culpa for past romantic, I don't know what, you were comparing it to the legal system. So,
yeah, just, it was written in the form of a criminal profile.
Right, and you persuaded some of your past lovers to write some very candid comments. How did you even get them? Why did you want to do it? And how did you get these women to tell you the truth? Listen up, folks. If you want to know, especially men, you want to know how women really feel about things, you want to read that chapter, because there's a lot of truth talk in there. But, you know, how did you do that?
I mean, I gave them, I mean, I told them what I was working on and the kind of struggles that I was having with it, and that there was an unfair male perspective in it, and offered them the opportunity. I don't know, opportunity is not the right word. I offered them I asked them, would they speak? Is probably a better way to put it. And not everyone was ready or willing to speak, but I commend the women that did. And it wasn't, I didn't ask them to write anything. I actually went and sat down and interviewed them. So it was it's different. I think if I had just said write it, then I think it could have come out differently, and also probably I think it was good for me to be in the room and to hear it and to see it and to see their reactions while they were saying these things, and be able to ask, you know, follow-up questions while it was happening.
Yeah, I mean, the candor was clear. So I just really appreciated that.
I was reading what you had to say about revising. I know when I'm writing something, revising for me involves a lot of scratching out stuff or trying different words, going to sleep and waking up and starting again. How do you see revising one's life?
Same process. I mean, I think revision takes a kind of reassessing of the ultimate goal, or having at least some goal in mind, even if you don't know what the ultimate goal is, seeing where you've kind of satisfied what you needed, the standards, and then where you fell short. I think it also requires an imagination. Like, you know, it's different than just editing and you catching a spelling error or a typo. Like, you also have to be able to revision, structure or motive or thesis, be able to reimagine scenes, to recreate scenes. So I think in the same way, I'm like doing that out in the world. Like, I don't know how you get from, you know, getting a pocket full of candy from Mr. Cole to a classroom at NYU, except that you kind of reimagine I wanted to be a doctor. I figured out very early I wasn't good at math. I wanted to be a lawyer. I don't really know where that came from. I wanted to be a basketball player, but none of those things pointed towards a classroom to me. And so I think that takes a fair amount of revision to get there, which is imagining, reassessing, trying again, scratching it out, all of the things that I do in the work.
Now, when you sit down to write, how many hours do you actually spend at a setting?
I wish I had a regular practice. I used to feel very guilty about that practice. I kind of given myself a little space. But when I'm in, when I have the time, and especially if I'm under deadline, the most that I write is like 12 to 14 hours. That does not happen often. That's probably, you know, I might do that for a month and a half to 2 months out of the year. Usually I'm just scribbling notes and scenes down, you know, when I can, so on the train or between classes. But when I'm like in, not in revision, but when I'm in drafting, I often keep a notebook. So I'm constantly thinking about what it is I want to set down, even if I'm not writing. And again, it's me probably giving myself a pass, but I read about Edward P. Jones. He worked through the known world in his head for, I think he said it was either 13 years or it was 10 years, and then he wrote it all in 6 weeks. I don't think that I can do that, but I do think there's something to working through the language and the story in your head before you set it down, which is not separate from the writing process.
I'm curious, what has been the response to this book, not just from your family and not from the critics, but just people, excuse me, in general? I did hear one person that I happen to speak to said, well, this is such a negative portrayal of Portland, which I don't see. I see so much love in this book, but, you know, people see what they see. So what kinds of responses have you gotten?
I haven't really received many responses from my family. I don't come from a family of readers. I don't know how many of them have actually read the entire thing. I think there's a certain amount of pride that they have that I just made a book. And I think they, you know, they'll read an article maybe or interview. I think some of the readers that I've encountered while I was out on tour, they seem to like the book. A lot of people say, you know, oh, it's not a Portland that I know about. And I think that's fair if you only have known about Portland through the media. But I also feel like if you write a book and everyone loves it, you probably didn't push far enough. like, I mean, I would love for there to be a consensus of acclaim, but I also feel like with people having so many different paradigms, views, politics, like, how could everyone love it? I do think about the people who I was writing for, and I hope that they, even if they don't love it, that they respect what I've done.
Well, I'm looking at like the four pages of fairly loving praise for the book, and also, you know, so I mean, I think overall you have to say people do love this book, but it's interesting how it's just interesting to see the lens. I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. I heard an interview with you, and you had mentioned that Big Chris had taken you someplace and said something mm-hmm. like, you know, if you don't mention it, I'll give you whatever. And the interviewer mm-hmm. was like, that's very manipulative. Why, that's the mm-hmm. same practice that he would do with the prostitutes. And I thought, no, that's what you do with little kids. You say, I'm going to give you a piece of candy. It's like, it is not that deep. It's just trying to bribe a child. And so it was like, Nikki Giovanni has this poem called Nikki Rosa, and she talks about how she sees her life and how other people, and she ends up by saying something like, I really hope, no, and she wrote this many years ago, I'm sure some of her politics has changed, but she said, I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me because they never understand black love is black wealth, and they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was really quite happy. I mean, maybe we are not all the while happy, but there is joy in life that people outside of it don't necessarily understand. And I mean, wow, the love that you have for your family and your composite of dads, which I would like you to talk about, and just your community. To me, it was so evident. And I thought, wow, you know, people bring what they bring to every situation. But so I'm happy that the response has been positive overall.
Well, I'm very glad that you saw that in it, because I do have a lot of love for the community and the people that I grew, even people who I had, you know, altercations with, like, I still see them as part of a community. Like, I know that we grew up in a lot of, you know, systemic problems, so I recognize that we were all kind of playing roles that we didn't even necessarily know who created them for us.
Mm-hmm. The community, the world you're describing, how often do you come back to Portland?
As often as I can, which lately has been about 5 times a year.
So you have seen the changes. Like, I feel like every week when I drive somewhere, something has changed.
Yeah.
But thinking about how Portland has changed from the 70s until now, do you think that the same community that existed in the 70s and 80s, could the same things happen now that happened then?
Well, I think they are happening, right, in the area where we exist. I remember when Residue came out, I went to a community meeting. This is when we had Mayor Hales. It was actually the first time that I met him. And it was a meeting of Mayor Hales, a police chief, some community organization leaders, and they had something printed out of the police activity they started off with police activity in Northeast Portland, and there was like zero police activity in Northeast Portland, and then they showed the police activity in the numbers, and it was like a robbery, a shooting, and I was like, wow, like, I can imagine going to this same meeting in 1990 or 1988 or 1995, and this same activity that was out on the east side would be in Northeast Portland. And I said, it really, well, I don't know if this is true, but it seemed like they had just relocated the issues that Northeast Portland was facing, and that it seemed like if they could do that, if they could just move the crime where they wanted to, that they was in their control to kind of to address it in a different way too. So I do think that there are some of the same issues going on out in the numbers, but I also still think, like, I hear about people starting up community organizations. I just saw a young guy the other day on Facebook saying he's starting a clothing drive for kids, and, you know, SEI is still around. It's been around since the 80s. So there are all these kind of positive things about the community that I think, you know, you got to be inside of it really to know that these things are happening. But you know, when I've been out, I've been really trying to resist or combat the kind of microscopic view about Portland, about my family history. Like, no, it's not just that we were all, you know, selling drugs and pimping and doing all of that. There was a lot of positive things, and even people who weren't whose lifestyles weren't you know, were looked down upon, they still had a lot of qualities that I admired.
Looking at this whole book, I see a number of positive things. No one would have ever mentioned Irvin Park as part of a tourist attraction here in Portland. It took me on a walk today. I had to go back there and see those tennis courts you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to watch Terrell Brandon play on those tennis courts when I was young. When he was in the NBA, he would come home on the off season, be over there all day playing tennis.
Well, you know, talking about your connection to Portland, you were in town recently for the Association of Writers and Writing Programs conference, and during that time, you were honored by Self Enhancement, Inc. So would you tell our listeners who might not have been able to make that program what it was about, how it came to be?
So it was a program. They are, I guess they're reimagining themselves into a cultural center.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is reinvigorating the library. And probably like a year ago, I won a fellowship, and one of the awards, the way the fellowship was administered, they gave me some money to work on a project, but they also gave me money to donate to a nonprofit. They wanted the nonprofit to be one that worked with in the prisons, but I pressed them and said that, you know, I think it's good to donate money to organizations that are working in the prisons, but I also think it's good if you can catch the kids before they get to prison. And so I really pushed for SEI, and ultimately they gave me the money to donate to SEI. And then a few weeks later, my friend who works there is Dante Paschel. And he called me and he was like, man, we're redoing this library and we want you to be involved with it. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you want to donate some money or something. I was like, well, Tay, like, I don't know if you know, but I just donated some money a couple of weeks ago. But yes, I do want to be involved with the library. So, you know, let's figure out what we can do. And ultimately, they decided to donate space to me in the library, which, you know, is one of the greatest honors that I've had as a writer. To have some space in a place that really was a savior for me when I was young. I mean, I worked at SEI all through high school. I was in SEI camp back in 83 or 84. So I've known Tony and Ray and Mr. Allen, I mean, for all of my memories.
And Emma and I were actually at the event, so that's why I recognize the love in the book, because there was just so much love for you, and it was reciprocated at that event, and that you were good enough to bring some of your friends, some other authors who were in town you know, for AWP, and have them add to the evening. It was a lovely evening. So, you know, no matter how far away you go, we know you are our hometown guy. And I think we're getting down to the nub. We have like about, I don't know, maybe 50 seconds left. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I think we covered it. I'm just really, I'm a proud Portlander, Oregonian. To me, it was really important to situate us in history. I don't want someone to look at us 50 years from now and have someone be the only people that wrote our stories. I think that's but I also think it's important not just to tell our stories, but to contextualize them, to investigate them, to historicize them. So it's not just the story, it's like, what's the thinking behind the story?
Exactly. Are you coming back to Portland for a book signing?
I did a book signing at Powell's on the 11th. I will be back. I'm not sure. I'm coming to teach at this program called Tin House in the summer, but I don't know. I'll be back before then. I'm just not sure of the date yet.
All right. We're looking forward to seeing you again.
All right. Thank you.
This is Black Book Talk on KBOO. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, and thank you.
Thank you. But now the road got rough, you're alone. Trying to raise two bad kids on your own.
May is Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Month. So to recognize our Asian and Pacific Islander American identified community, Cable will be airing all Asian and Pacific Islander programming from 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd. That day, we'll be airing features from your favorite API KBOO programmers. Tune in to hear episodes of Lip Fantastic, APA Compass, DMA Roberts' award-winning series, Crossing East, and an all-new Pacific Underground and music playlist by Sun Lee and DJ Diablo. That's Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Day, Friday, May 3rd, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. For more information and program schedule, just go to our website at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. It's noon. Stay tuned for your noon news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 20th Annual Global Cannabis March and Oregon Cannabis Festival on Saturday, May 5th from noon to 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square at 701 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. The Global Cannabis March and Oregon Cannabis Festival features a rally, bands, speakers, and vendor booths. Again, that's the 20th Annual Global Cannabis March and Oregon Cannabis Festival on Saturday, May 5th from noon to 5 at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 701 6th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.